Hey, everybody, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to Device Talks Weekly. I'm here with my great friend and our fantastic managing editor, Kayleen Brown. Kayleen.
Hello.
Hey. You're back on the podcast. I know we took a couple of, a couple of weeks off, but you've got a lot to talk about. Our brains are spinning. We're planning for Device Talks West, and it's like go time. I feel like there's this big clock over my head that just like constantly ticking down like a really bad pharmaceutical commercial. So
I am with you on that. I've been having the pre-conference nightmares. Do you get those?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't yet this year, knock wood, but now that you mention it, I probably will. Thank you, Kayleen.
Sorry, I planted that seed.
But we are making progress, and you had a very important phone call this week. Tell us all about it.
I did. So I am so thrilled, and you'll be the first to know, so make sure to keep it just between the two of us.
And you haven't even told me the news yet.
Exactly.
So my response will be genuine. Yes.
Yes. So we have the official theme for this year's Women in MedTech Breakfast. That's going to be hosted, of course, at Device Talks West with Darla Hutton, Intuitive's VP of Global Cardiac Surgery. So after discussing what's important to Darla, her background, her point of view, and her perspective, we've narrowed it down to the power of global representation.
I like
right?
it.
Right?
Yeah.
So this one's really interesting because Darla's experience is rich at Intuitive, yes, but she recently returned from Singapore, where mm-hmm. she hosted the inaugural Asian Women in Da Vinci Surgery event.
Wow.
Right? So surgeons from China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, India, and more came together to talk about their own personal stories of resilience, innovation, cultural perspective. So for me, this was an absolute no-brainer. Darla brings a real global lens to this topic, women in med tech. And from there, we're going to be talking about how not only does global representation matter when it comes to innovation, but so does gender and culture that comes mm-hmm. from that. And we, as usual, we will touch on mentorship and we'll touch on how we can work together to move that needle forward. But yeah, Tom, this year, global representation.
I love it. And it's consistent with the kind of part of the opening conversation I'll have with Tim Schmidt at J&J is talking about his career, which has spanned the globe, and J&J's global reach, and their executive team draws from all over. And I think global relations is kind of a hot topic these days, you know, kind of making the news and the headlines. So I think it's...
Yeah, and this is, Darla and I were kind of going back and forth with it yesterday, just finessing the finer points. And I was saying, from my perspective of being in the United States, especially, I don't know if the news has heard a lot about Portland, Oregon, which is where I live. Mm-hmm. It's important to stay grounded, and it's important to remember that where we are right now is a blip in the larger scheme of things, and focusing on, I think, our relationships and our interactions globally instead of maybe where we are right now and regionally, but globally, I think is a really important way to remember what we're trying to do and keep mm-hmm. doing what's important and not getting stuck where we are right now. So I'm glad to hear that you're going to be exploring that with Tim. I'm going to be exploring that with Darla. And I hope that our attendees of Device Talks West reach out to both of us and offer up questions. You know, maybe somebody can ask a question directly from you to Tim and from me to Darla. So please message us on LinkedIn, please.
Absolutely. We want everyone to be involved. So that sounds like a great conversation. That will kick off, as it always does, day two of Device Talks. So folks can register for Device Talks at west.devicetalks.com. And then within that registration process, there's an opportunity to register specifically for the breakfast. And folks should definitely get on that because that always, we've sold those out. And I can't imagine we won't this time around with such a great speaker. And I think a real fascinating topic. So great job, Kayleen Brown.
Oh, well, thank you, Intuitive, and thank you, Darla Hutton.
So while I'm at AbdoMed next week, Kayleen, you'll be hosting our Device Talks deep dive with your very best friend, Dennis Chang of Boston Scientific. What are you talking about?
So we're going to be talking about AI, because you know I live by AI, in cardiac mm-hmm. diagnostics. And you're absolutely right. I can't wait to sit down with my BFF, not even best friend, best friend forever. Dennis and I are now intertwined forever. We'll be sitting down together on October 7th, and this conversation comes to you courtesy of our sponsors, S3 Connected Health, Electrocraft, MTD Micromolding, Confluent Medical Technologies, and Interpower. So I hope everybody gets a chance who's not attending AdvaMed to join me and my BFF as we talk about AI.
It's painful to learn I'm not your BFF here in the podcast, so publicly, it's just...
You could have
sent me a Slack. All right.
Well, I wanted to do it in a public place, you know, make sure that if you were going to cry that you held it back.
Oh, I'm trying
to be here for
but
you.
But I will hold it back. And folks can watch it live, of course, but if you are at AdvaMed and you'd be foolish not to want to watch this conversation, you can also watch it on demand. You won't get your questions answered, but you can watch other folks get their questions answered. So lots of ways for you to be part of that conversation. All right. So we covered Device Talks West. We covered our deep dive. This episode, I think, is exceptional. I had a conversation with Christian Howell. He's the CEO of Cognito Therapeutics. Cognito Therapeutics will be represented at Device Talks West, but we did have a long conversation. And it was really a fascinating conversation. I don't want to give away too much, but he was in the Navy at a particularly critical time in U.S. history, and he's a one of us type of person, Kayleen Brown. He's a med-techer.
One of us.
Through and through. And Cognito is targeting dementia, which is, as we'll talk about in the interview, just a critical area that needs lots of help. So enjoy that conversation. And if you want to learn more about what's going on in neuro, join us at Device Talks West. I'll talk about it later in the podcast, but we've got a great panel with some great panelists, and I'll be leading that conversation about advances in neurotechnology. So go to west.devicetalks.com for more information, and go to devicetalks.com for information about everything, about our podcasts, about our webinars, about our in-person events. All right, Kayleen Brown.
Well, let's get started.
All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Neumarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. How you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing all right. It's a late night last night watching my Red Sox lose to the dreaded
Yankees. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. Evil Empire. Dun, 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 dun.
The playoffs have a way of highlighting teams' weaknesses, and defense has always been our Achilles heel all year, and it's certainly what kind of bit us in the butt this go around. So
talking about Star Wars, It dawned on me.
I was talking about baseball, but go ahead. Star Wars.
I mean, come on. The Yankees are...
Oh, I see. Know, right, I mean, umpire. Continue.
Yes. I mean, come on.
Yeah, pull the thread. Just, go on.
I'm sorry. It's like this is... Yeah, the end of this movie was more like... The end of this series was more like Empire Strikes Back.
Well, next season, so hopefully the Red Sox get some Ewoks on their team. And
yeah, that's right. Ewoks are really good running out of the outfield.
It'd be tough to pitch to. The strike zone would be very small.
Yeah. You really have to work hard pitching to an Ewok. And then, but anyway, I think we've teased it before, but Device Talk Minnesota coming back next year to May 4th.
That's right.
At the McNamara.
Oh, okay. So May the 4th be with you.
May the 4th be with you.
We'll have to build that into the marketing.
I think Funny Socks are still in a bit, right?
I think everyone should come dressed as their favorite Star Wars character.
Scary. No. We do have kind of like that beard, like that slight like grunge beard thing going on that makes us look Jedi like a bit.
Yeah, Liam Neeson kind of Jedi look.
This is a serious event talking about medtech innovation. We probably shouldn't dress as Jedi Knights
It's going to be a lot of people there, so no Jabba outfits with the swinging tail in the back. You're going to take a booth or table.
Somebody's going to trip. Yeah, we don't need that. All right. But anyway, I know we're both like really busy. We're getting ready for Device Talks West the weekend after next. So we're going to blaze through the Neumarker's newsmakers for this week. You ready, Tom?
I am ready. Number five, Chris Neumarker.
Well, number five on the list, we've got CoreWave reporting, positive first patient results with their membrane-based LVAS, a left ventricle assist system. So, just exciting news here. I mean, right now in the United States, the only LVAD commercially available is Abbott's HeartMate, which I mean, truly a device that has saved lives and allowed others to have a bridge to transplantation. But kind of exciting to see like other devices in this space moving forward, so that we can kind of have a little bit of competition here, have a little bit of different alternatives.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then this the article written by Daniel Kirsch, and I mean, there was a question. I know you wrote an article about after Device Talks Boston in 2023 about LVADs saving lives. Why aren't more available? Is this something that would you think would feed that supply someday potentially?
Could potentially feed that supply to have more of these more of these available. I mean, one of the interesting potentials of the CoreWave device is that because it's membrane based, it has like pulsatility, like it's like actually kind of more mimicking what the heart what a normal heart does in a cardiovascular system versus the current Abbott HeartMate, and people don't have a pulse with those. I mean, it's like a continual spinning pump.
Interesting.
Rotary pump that's going through them. But yeah, that could help. It's interesting. I learned over the summer, at least in Minnesota, I heard that it's actually very hard to find assisted living for people who have LVADs. Like a lot of those facilities don't want to, to deal with the liability. So I suspect that's another thing that's going on. So we, I think, I'm sure that would be a good question going forward, like with the industry, like what's Abbott doing to try to clear the way to, make it easier for people. I mean, it's great. These pumps are going to keep you alive when otherwise you might have not had a transplant. But I mean, when people are looking at options like assisted living, maybe you need dialysis. That's another thing. Dialysis clinics, I heard, and I need to do more reporting on it, aren't big on taking in people with LVADs. So I mean, there's definitely a lot of challenges around it, even though it's just this fantastic technology, but it seems like it's just like things with the healthcare system going on.
Sure. All right.
Yeah.
Well, important device. Great advance. We'll keep an eye on CoreWave. What's number four, Chris Neumarker?
Well, number four is Medtronic won a CE mark for their appendature left atrial appendage exclusion system. This is a this is a surgical LAA device. So kind of the idea, like you're doing an open heart surgery. A lot of times when people get heart surgery, or not a lot of, one of the complications that can arise from heart surgery is that you develop AFib. Doing that left atrial appendage exclusion in the heart like reduces the risk of stroke from AFib. So I mean, it's kind of like this natural idea, like you're doing a heart surgery, great, we use this tool, we get that procedure done, when we have somebody opened up. This is competing against AtriCure, which has had its own devices in this, but anyway, it looks like a Medtronic is expanding its market for this device that's competing with the AtriCure. So we'll keep on following what's going on. And then meanwhile, there's like LAA devices that are catheter delivered, it's a catheter delivered procedure, especially like Boston Scientific. Well, actually, like Boston Scientific's Watchman device, that currently competes against Abbott's Amplatzer Amulet. So I mean, that there's that whole other space as well. So you're treating AFib, doing some kind of ablation procedure. You can also then run up this device to get an LAA done as well, like in a patient. So really interesting, just more options coming for people like with cardiovascular disease, heart and disease.
Sean Hooley wrote this one up. Also mentions Johnson & Johnson's acquisition of Laminar in the LAA space and Conformal Medical. So Sean's got a complete rundown of the space. All right, well, let us move on to number three, Chris Neumarker.
A lot going on, yeah. Number three on the list, we've got Olympus launching their OlliSense AI power colorectal polyp detection platform. So more, this has actually been a really big space for kind of like different like AI powered software. So coming on board in this space. This is a Sean Hooley article, but definitely interesting there. We're seeing more options coming around that.
All right. Well, great news from Olympus, and I think Sean will be talking to the new CEO Bob White at AdvaBen next week. So hopefully we'll see some
fantastic
some words. At least he's meeting with them. I think we're both going to try to meet with them. So it'd be great to get an update from the new CEO, newish
definitely,
CEO.
Definitely, yeah. Like some more exciting news coming out of Olympus since Bob White took over there. Yeah. So.
Well, number two. Let's go into number two.
Number two. Well, I mean, number two on the list. I mean, we've got, reports like Bloomberg Law saying that there's going to be, some changes in the ownership over at Siemens Healthineers. I mean, at this point, they were kind of spun off from Siemens, but Siemens has had like a 71% ownership in Siemens Healthineers, and it looks like, Siemens is going to look for like some kind of strategy to kind of spin off that remaining ownership, stake. The report in Bloomberg Law was even, saying that, even claimed that, perhaps Siemens will just consider distributing the Siemens Healthineers shares to its investors as a dividend. So, that's interesting news, a change at like one of the largest medical device companies in the world. So according to our MedTech Big 100, which is now available on medical design outsourcing. So,
all right. Well, interesting news from Siemens. Siemens has certainly been making a lot of news lately with its surgical robotics arrangements, partnerships with Stryker, Interventional Systems, and others, as you mentioned. And definitely be one to watch. Yes. All right, Kristen Barker.
Things are happening over at Siemens Healthineers. And number one on the list, this is from yours truly. I wrote this.
Way to go, Chris.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, I gotta put on all the hats when you're running something. So I got this was really interesting. Like during a July earnings call that I was, following with Zimmer Biomet, the CEO, Evan Tornos. He kind of briefly mentioned like that there was something like with iodine technology on orthopedic implants, and that they were really, excited about this as, being a game changer, that they were trying it out in Japan and they could see a path in the U.S. With it. And, fast forward, actually, he said it was going to be transformational. Actually, that was the word that he used. Then fast forward just a few months, and we have, news from Zimmer Biomet that they've won Japanese regulatory approval for a total hip system that features this infection resistant iodine coating technology, which they're describing as, a first. It looks just like another Zimmer Biomet hip systems, but it's got a darker color because it's got this iodine coating on it. And they were kind of pointing to research that shows, this is actually quite startling, that having a prosthetic prosthetic joint infection with a hip procedure is the mortality rate of that is comparable to getting breast cancer. Having this technology that reduces the odds of that happening that's something that could make a difference here. And iodine is an essential body nutrient, and we kind of all know it too, because that's especially our generation, Tom, when we skinned a knee or whatever, that's, what the parents were like putting on the, the
just
skin.
Put some butter on it, didn't we? I forget what we put on it. Just
Yeah, that's right. It was butter. Yeah, butter.
Just the boo-boo, and then send you out your way.
Salted butter or unsalted butter?
Oh, that hurt. The salted butter.
Salted butter.
We had salted and unsalted back then. We just had butter, and we liked it.
It's just butter. Like you had to milk the cow in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. Oh, gosh. No, but, it was a great, I mean, yeah, this is like, you know, this is
it
like
makes
some
sense.
Cool tech.
It makes total sense. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and got the approval in Japan. It was developed in Japan. Like, so like they were, you know, this is like the technology. So that's kind of cool too. There's kind of like a global aspect of this new tech that it's something that came, you know, came out of Japan. I mean, it's really cool that we're here in this, you know, global industry where you can see stuff like, you know, getting developed all over the world. So, so very cool. And we'll, you know, like I'll be watching for, you know, the next steps for them getting into the US. Got a PR person, Zimmer Biomet, you know, looking to arrange for me to, you know, talk to somebody there more about the technology. So it'll be fun to cover that more as well.
Fantastic. Now it's nice to have an orthopedic innovation conversation that doesn't center around sensors or data or things like that, like actual innovation within the implant itself. I know there's always, this is cementless, this is not cementless. And that's important too, but this is a cool new thing. So
doing something with the hardware. So yeah,
it's exactly. Yeah, exactly. Cool. All right. And of course, we'll see Ivan Tornos and their, well, what's Arnold Schwarzenegger's title again? The chief movement officer, chief movement officer.
That's yes. Right. Yeah.
They'll be there on Monday. So that will be, I'm sure, a fun take. At AdvaMed. So
yeah, that'll be a fun one. Yeah.
If folks are out there, please look for me and say hello. If you're not out there, but you've got conference FOMO, of course, we'd love to have you at Device Talks West the following week.
And, you know, of course, senior editor Sean Hooley will be at AdvaMed next week as well. So like, yeah, look out for Tom, look out for Sean. We got the Boston crew in California next week.
Yeah. Early flight on Sunday morning, boy. It's going to be fun. Man. But all right, Chris Neumarker, lots of great news.
Fantastic.
Great industry. Thanks so much.
I was like, hey, next year, man, the Red Sox, they're gonna win the World Series, man.
Go Ewoks. Woo-hoo.
Woo, Ewoks. Da-da-da-da-da. All right, have a good one, Tom. Take care.
All right, thanks, Chris Neumarker. Now we'll move into our FOMO section of the podcast. My guest this week is Jacqueline Lotz. She is the COO of a company called Ivy Watch. It's a cool technology, not something that we typically profile, and I'll get into that in the conversation. I introduced Catherine as interim CEO. She was at the time. She's COO now. She was both when I interviewed her. Now she's COO. But let's hear from Jacqueline Lotz. Again, she's Chief Operating Officer at Ivy Watch. Well, Jacqueline Lotz, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Tom.
Nice to have you here. Nice to hear about Ivy Watch. This isn't a type of technology that we focus a lot on in Device Talks. So it's an area we want to look at. I know you had some positive news lately. So talk a bit about Ivy Watch. What is the problem that came to lead you and lead Ivy Watch to develop the solution that we'll learn about in a moment?
Yeah, sure. So we are solving a global problem. Just like you and your friends and family have all probably received an IV at some point in time. About 90% of folks that go into a hospital are getting an IV, and there's over 2 billion IVs that are placed annually globally, which is a really high volume.
Sure.
And so when you think about IVs and how important they are to deliver the drug to the patient or the fluid, there's actually a really common problem where it can leak outside of the vein for various reasons, whether the catheter backs out, punctures through, or there could be porosity changes in the vein. It's a very common problem globally, and really depending on the drug, it can cause everything from some harm with pain and swelling to even permanent damage like tissue injury, and in extreme cases, amputation.
Wow.
And so this is a common problem. It's global. And it's also something that there's no other product like it on the market. Current standard of practice is actually nurses coming in and doing routine assessments of the IV site. So they'll touch, they'll look, compare, they'll use some of their clinical tools to assess the IV site. But unfortunately, because they're routine checks every hour, every 4 hours, depending on what the protocol is, also they're detecting it when the injury has already started to progress and has already happened. And so you think about that and how busy the nurses are in today's world, there's really a need for a product or technology that can actually provide continuous monitoring. So that's where Ivy Watch comes to play.
What are those signs? What are the the nurses looking at. As you were introducing me to the problem, I was thinking the only real way to pick that up would be physically seeing a problem, like either the patient would pick up on it or the nurse would pick up on it. But are the, then you mentioned that there are sort of tools and things to look at. How clear is it that there's a problem? Is it clearly like there's a kink in the line, something very visible, or does each sort of inspection require like a good couple of minutes to really get an assessment of the site?
So typically what the nurses will do is, as part of their requirements, go in and look at the IV site. Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, there, if a patient is aware, they could say, oh, my IV hurts, which you can imagine in a hospital setting would be uncommon because folks can be sedated. Mm-hmm. If it's pediatrics or infants, they can't necessarily communicate there's pain. So when the nurse comes in and does the assessment, they're looking at the IV site. Is it swollen? Is it red? They're comparing it to, for example, if it's a IV on a hand, they're looking at both the right hand and the left hand to see if there's any swelling that's occurred. And so also they could use something like called a saline flush. They'll actually flush saline into the IV site and see if there's any pressure or pain that would indicate the infiltration has started. So they're very rudimentary clinical tools that are currently used standardly, but our product comes to play because we have the continuous monitoring and we detect so early that the injury has not progressed yet.
So this is clearly a hot spot or a hot area for or a big need for clinical settings. I mean, there's a shortage of nurses. They're overworked. They're burned out. So, and all the tools you've described, I'm guessing, have been around for ever.
I mean, there's nothing. Probably since IVs were placed.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no real innovation there.
Yeah, so, there's no other product in the entire world that continuously monitors the IV site. Nothing else that's providing that seatbelt for the patient.
So we've whetted people's appetite. We've presented the problem, I think, in a really great way. What is your solution? What's IV Watch developed and how does it work?
Yep. So I already mentioned that we have a solution that provides continuous monitoring. And so you can see here, I have our sensor. And so we have a patient monitoring system. So there's a monitor cable, but really the brains of the operation is this sensor. It's disposable and it's actually placed next to an IV site. And it's an optical sensor. So it's looking at has a couple wavelengths of light that come through this blue sensor head, and it's sending light, it's receiving a signal, and it's looking for specific changes underneath the tissue that would indicate the drug has started to pool outside of the vein, which is really where it starts to look at the injury starting to occur. It's early signs, but the system issues audible and visual alerts to the clinician that something is happening and you need to come do something about it.
So for those folks on the podcast who are listening, you tape the device to your wrist. It's part of a sticky package. And I'd say the blue thing is what, about the size of a nickel maybe? I mean, it's not very large.
Yeah, it's very small, smaller than a nickel, more like a dime size, and it's very flexible. So, I mean, I'm placing it on my hand here, but you can imagine a very small patient, maybe a preemie baby. Our sensor is very flexible, and the format, you can wrap it around very small limbs so that you have the protection on there to check for what's going on.
So what is it looking at again, and how is it getting the information to the healthcare provider so they can come and address a problem if there is one?
Sure. So as I mentioned, there's a couple wavelengths of light in the sensor, and it's sending light and it's receiving back. And it's looking for optical changes in the tissue. So there are specific changes that happen underneath that tissue as the drug or the fluid starts to leak into the tissue. Uh-huh. And so our algorithm looks for a variety of parameters and factors, but when it starts to determine that the leakage is starting to occur, it's early signs, and it will issue both an audible and visual notification to the clinician to then come to the IV site. And what we find with customers that are most successful with the product and see the most positive outcomes is when they have very strong protocols on how to use IV Watch. What do you do when there's the red alert that has occurred, and so that they are having the positive outcomes with a product?
Amazing. So where are you in development and approval in commercialization? What's your status?
So we have two sensors that are in market. One, the sensor that I talked about, the disposable sensor. We have our FDA clearance and also CE mark. We have approval to sell into 16 countries. We've been in the US for several years. So we're in market. We have key accounts that have implemented the technology and are seeing positive impacts, not just from a clinical standpoint, because, you know, in the hospital setting, everybody will agree with you want to improve patient safety, you want to improve patient outcomes. But then there's also the economic side where our product reduces the costs of these injuries. Anything from it could be just the extended stay required, the extra nursing time, to extreme cases. Perhaps there was an amputation and a major lawsuit.
Interesting. So what has the reception been from healthcare providers? I have to think this is, you certainly get some phone calls returned, I would imagine.
Yeah, so it's very positive. I think no matter what hospital or healthcare system you're talking to, this problem exists. There is no hospital in the world that does not have infiltration extravasation. So I think when you're thinking about the customer and hospitals and healthcare systems, having that clinical solution is a no-brainer. The next part of that is really, we don't just provide a product, we're also looking at best practice. So how do you best keep track of these types of events? How do you improve your clinical practices to improve that? So it's been very positive because there's nothing else in the world that can provide this extra layer of safety.
That's amazing. So looking forward, what do you see for the future of IV technology? I have to think that this is a real, not only a clinical need, but it's probably a real pain point for healthcare providers. I imagine that technology like this is going to make that whole process, I would hope, a little easier in the coming years.
Yeah, and I think over the past several years, I mean, healthcare is moving to more a proactive prevention versus a reactive approach. So where we are clinically with IV monitoring is very reactive. It's very reactive when the injury has already occurred or the patient is already in the state of harm. And so IV Watch, we're really aligning to where the market is going with a proactive preventative approach. I mean, these types of events are preventable. And so our vision as a company is there really should be no patient that suffers from these preventable types of events. And with the right technology like IV Watch, that's possible. So that's where things are going for the market.
Fantastic. Well, it's a great MedTech story, a huge problem that I'm sure many people listening can connect to. And Jacqueline Lotz, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It was nice chatting today.
All right, now we'll get into our keynote conversation. I spoke with Christian Howell at Cognito Therapeutics. Christian was going to be a speaker at Device Talks West, but something came up. He was kind enough to make sure that Ralph Hurd came, the chief medical officer for Cognito Therapeutics. So the panel that he's on is well staffed. We've got Kurt Hagstrom from Synchron. He's chief commercial officer. We have Tatiana Alexandrova. She's the CEO of Subsense. So this is going to be a real far-ranging conversation at Device Talks West, looking at new ways to engage the brain. And that's something I spoke with Christian about in this episode. But first, we unpacked his story. Quite remarkable. He was in the Navy to start, and I started asking questions about it, not anticipating the answers that I'd get. So Christian was a terrific guest. Very thoughtful. And of course, Cognito Therapeutics is working on something extremely important. So without any further delay, let's get this keynote conversation started. Well, Christian Howell, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate you having me.
It's a pleasure to tell Cognito's story. I know we'll have you at Device Talks West. Your CMO, Ralph Kern, will be there on a panel. But in this episode, I want to unpack the Cognito story. But first, I want to understand your story a bit and how you found your way into the medtech industry. Your career started in the Navy, correct? That was your first non-college role, so to speak?
It did. You know, I was incredibly fortunate. My father was both a veteran and spent his career in the pharmaceutical industry, but always sourced to me and my brothers that you know, we should have a sort of a career of service. And no matter what we do, we should always be thinking about being in service to others. And so my first opportunity to do that was when I graduated from college. I was commissioned as an officer in the Navy and had the opportunity to serve, which was an incredible experience for me. And it really, I think it really gave me the first opportunity to think about putting, one, others' interests above my own, but two, also the incredible power of a mission-driven organization. And when an organization has a very clear mission, just what's capable to be accomplished.
And that was an interesting time for the Navy as well. You was in the mid to late 90s. Cold War was subsiding, but there was certainly a lot of pressure on the Navy at that point. All across the world, were you did you see any have any interesting experiences?
I did. I have one of the more unique experiences in which I was stationed in the Persian Gulf conducting piracy work on the afternoon of September 11th.
Oh my gosh.
And so that was an amazing time to really one to experience that from afar, which I'm sure. But then also to experience that there, you can probably remember there was a period of time between the events of what was that afternoon for us, but that morning for the United States. And then when we retaliated in early October and really working with the sailors and the Marines on the ship to keep sort of focus, because there were so many distractions, right? There was the distractions of what was going on at home. There were the distractions of when would we respond. So, you know, I always talk about that was an amazing, almost 30 days, but yeah, it was an incredible time to be, serving the country.
I mean, certainly, our anxieties heightened here in the States. I can't imagine being out in a ship in the middle of the area where, you know, it was assumed if not known, that there was a region where the attackers came from. What was, did life change almost immediately on that ship from, oh, we're doing this really interesting foreign tour to, and obviously doing duty as well too, we are in the middle of something much bigger.
Yeah, it changed dramatically, right? I mean, there, so much of the Navy's principles are around power projection. And so in the first 5 months or so of that tour, it was about taking the ships and the battle group and the carrier group into different ports to show, you know, what the American Navy is capable of. And then it really changed to this very sort of singular sort of objective. Mm-hmm. And I remember on that afternoon, it was, you know, the Straits of Hormuz can be a very dangerous and complicated place. And I remember on that afternoon bringing in, you know, two different carrier groups to bring three carrier groups out. And by that evening, they had laid the island of Manhattan down in the Indian Ocean. And what we would do is we would patrol the different neighborhoods of Manhattan, but overlaid against in the ocean. So you would see Soho or, you know, Upper West Side, but it was just simply overlaid onto a chart. But it kind of kept it front and center for us, right? That we wanted to make sure we kept front and center what was happening in the United States.
That was an intentional strategy to sort of drive home the point of what you were doing there?
That's right. I mean, it was a time where it was, you know, about a year earlier, the USS Cole had been
attacked. Thinking about the Cole when I asked my question. So, yeah.
So that really changed the daily life in the Navy as we thought about, you know, the ways that we protected the ships and the sailors and aircraft when we were forward deployed and even when we were home. But after September 11th, it made it much less abstract. Right, because it wasn't in the idea of just prevention and defense. It became much more sort of offensive, and you know, so it was an absolute amazing experience. And then, you know, for me, it's actually a very common progression to go. You know, I thought I was going to go to law school. I was serving as the legal officer on the ship. I was, and then a friend of mine sort of encouraged me to go to a junior military officer recruitment fair. And it's very common for medical device companies to recruit junior military officers, into commercial roles. Not surprising, they're driven and they're competitive and they're ambitious. And so was hired into a medical device company, and then really started what was a fascinating experience between Covidien and Medtronic, where I spent almost 20 years in an array of commercial leadership roles and marketing and doing some business development and doing partnership development. And then was incredibly fortunate that got to work for Omar Ishrak and the leadership of Medtronic as he was introducing the sort of the key strategy of value-based healthcare, right? And we all remember Omar had this grand vision of shifting Medtronic from a $30 billion company based in volume to a $30 billion company based in value. And he recognized to do that, he was going to have to do it in really robust partnership with health systems and payers. And so I was incredibly fortunate to lead that initiative and wanted, it gave me an opportunity to really understand the inner workings of health systems. And again, in this idea of being in service, you know, being in service to healthcare providers and trying to understand what was the right intervention for patients at the right time and care. But it also gave me an opportunity to learn from Omar and Jeff and Rick Kuntz, who was the chief medical officer, and see how they were guiding a company of this size and the fidelity to the mission and how they were balancing the messaging internally to the messaging internally. So it was a leadership intensive for me, which I just loved.
What do you draw from your Navy experience? We're obviously seeing a lot of great emphasis on med tech vets and a lot, really, I think shining a necessary light on the as you said, the common transition or frequent transition of vets into med tech. But I think we're putting some emphasis on that, and that's great. What in your day to day now, especially as CEO, where you're setting a path for things, what do you draw from your military training/experience? Is it anything conscious, or do you think there's just kind of an imprint there that you are familiar with and that you utilize? How does that experience play in your day-to-day life as CEO?
Yeah, you know, in two ways, and I'll give you just sort of a macro and a micro. The micro for me is I kind of constantly have this calculus going on in my head between responsibility and accountability, right? And one of the primary lessons that you learn as an officer in the Navy is that you have to be comfortable delegating responsibility. You cannot do everything, but you have to do it in a way that is thoughtful and intentional, and so that, because you're going to maintain accountability for it, right? And I think about that all the time at Cognito, which is there's incredible work being done by our clinical research team and our research and development teams and our commercial teams, but I have a responsibility to be accountable to that back to the board and then ultimately to the patient. So that's sort of a balance that's always going on in my head. And it was a really important distinction to understand in the Navy. And then the other is clarity and fidelity to a mission. You know, the Navy's is very sort of prominent, right? Support and defend the Constitution against against enemies, foreign and domestic. That is, you know, the oath that we all take, but what it gives is real clarity for folks when times get tough. What are we trying to do? And, you know, I have been very fortunate that if you think about, you know, a company like Medtronic, you know, that is also something that is incredibly important for them. Like, you know, it is not just on the walls when you walk into the building, and it's not just something that is talked about in kind of the abstract of, you know, alleviate pain, restore health, extend life, but it was for Omar, and it is for Jeff and Bill George and other leaders. It is a guiding strategic principle that, you know, Earl Bakken gave them, and Omar shared this with me, that he kind of gave the future leaders of Medtronic this wonderful gift of a mission that not only was aspirational and could really help, you know, the employees understand the impact that they were making, the service that they were having to others, but it was also strategic. Like a biomedical engineering company focused on, you know, these outcomes. And so I think those are the two, you know, this idea of accountability and responsibility and understand the distinction with them and being confident to empower responsibility amongst your teams, and then clarity to the mission of your organization so that your team is sort of constantly aware of what you're working toward.
I think that mission is palpable when you talk to folks or read LinkedIn comments from folks at Medtronic. I think the purpose is front and its center. When you get into accountability and responsibility, I have to think that you're in a position now where it's it's a lot easier being a smaller company with people you know, and a larger company, like how do you maintain that sort of trust and that culture when there's just so many people, there's so many variables, there's going to be some folks who are better than others, and that I don't really have a question other than it must be easier to be a small company than a large company, or maybe there's a secret to a large company that you're able to keep that alive.
I think there's pluses and minuses. I do completely agree with you, right? And I actually think this is where you'll see a lot of people over the course of their career find the sort of ecosystems that they most align to, yeah. Right? Where the clarity of responsibility or the ability to take accountability or responsibility for something, they feel very empowered by that. And I think maybe sometimes in larger organizations, it doesn't feel like the responsibility is wholly yours. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge in smaller organizations is that you oftentimes have shared responsibilities or multiple responsibilities. And I think as you're growing, the lines, you know, the unblurring of the lines can be very challenging, right? It's sort of, there is some comfort in the blurring of the lines that we're sort of all responsible. But if everyone's responsible, then no one's responsible. And so there is this sort of growing pain of a small company because we all want to expand up. Okay, how do I then also make sure that I'm maintaining this, this clarity to what
that's a great point. As you grow, if you're one of those people who feels responsible for everything, and then you suddenly look and realize that you're actually a bottleneck and you're stopping everything because everything's coming through your ear. You're like, I literally don't have enough time in the day to manage all of this. So you do get to a point where you have to let others manage it. So great conversation. I just want to touch quickly though. You spent 3 years at Adeon. I think I'm saying that's right.
Yeah.
That right. So you were buying, I mean, that's more of a data software kind of healthcare financials company, metrics company. If I'm defining incorrectly, let me know, but what that's medtech adjacent. What was it about that opportunity that appealed to you?
What was really compelling to me is that if the sort of three takeaways from my experience doing value-based healthcare, which was one, this idea of working with health systems and better understanding what happens within the four walls of a health system, and two, this opportunity to learn from Omar and the leadership of Medtronic, the third part was how unbelievably important data was into driving subjectivity out of healthcare. The only way you can achieve value-based healthcare is if the decisions are made objectively. It can't be, oh, I like the rep or I like the rebate. It has to be, the evidence tells me that this intervention will drive the best outcome or cost per outcome. And so then data becomes the absolute shibboleth of that, right? It becomes the code word. And so what became really interesting for me was I sort of took this away. And then when Medtronic, when Omar stepped down and Jeff was coming in, I think they were going to kind of lean out of value-based healthcare, but it became very clear to me that the ability for health systems and medical technology companies to better action data into evidence and then taking that evidence to make better decisions was gaining a lot of momentum. And so, you know, I went and talked to Josh Macauer at Stanford Biodesign, and I said, look, I've got this idea that I think med device companies should be really leaning into the use of real world data. They should be sharing their clinical data with health systems so health systems can conceptualize those trials within their own populations to determine, so, you know, what's the best intervention and when. And he said, yeah, you know, we actually just invested, he was with NEA at the time, and we had just invested in a company, Atheon, which was spun out of Harvard. And what they were doing is they were doing really robust analysis of real world data to help life science companies and payers and health systems make better decisions. And what was really interesting is Dr. Scott Gottlieb had just joined their board. And I one time heard him say that, you know, the evidentiary burden for drug therapies is in the pre-market, but so much of the evidentiary burden for devices is in the post-market, and therefore they have to be able to use real-world data. So I was connected to the CEO of Atheon and was hired as the GM of their med device and diagnostic business, and then ultimately took responsibility for their payer business and their government business. But working with med tech companies, data providers, FDA and others to say, okay, how can we look at data to determine which is the right intervention for which patient and when. and really enjoyed it. I felt a little step removed away from direct interaction with the patient, I will say. I really loved that about Medtronic and my med device career. It's like I really felt like I was directly in service to patients or directly in service to those that were treating patients. And then I got a call from Rick Kuntz, who was the chief medical and scientific officer at Medtronic, and he had joined the board at Cognito and introduced me to the CEO at the time and kind of said, look, I think there's something incredibly compelling happening here. And so I made the shift back to Cognito as the chief commercial officer, and then ultimately was asked to step in as CEO in June-ish of 24.
That's right. Did you have, I imagine CEO was a box on your list that you wanted to check at some point?
It was. I really, you know, I had been incredibly fortunate at my career at Medtronic, in which I had gotten to see really significant leaders up close. So I had got to work with Chris Berry. He obviously went on and became the CEO of NuVasive. I got to work very closely with Brian Hansen. He obviously went on and is doing the work that he's doing at Solventum. I worked with Jeff and with Omar. I got to see John Lidicote, you know, up close. I got to work with Scott Drake. So it was amazing for me that I really drew an inside straight at Medtronic and Covidien, that I got this opportunity to see this group that was ultimately going to become these leaders. And it really formed for me in many ways what to do, but also in many ways like what not to do or how would I do it differently. But I want the opportunity to be able to guide a mission-driven company that I thought could make an impact, that could make a significant impact. And that was really my calculus, was I wanted to make sure that when I made the choice or got the opportunity to become a CEO, I wanted to make sure that I felt like the mark and the impact to patients was going to be significant. That was the driver for me. And I really do think I would have taken my sort of time and being very selective about that.
Well, let's talk about Cognito and the opportunity and first your move it to CCO. So Cognito is, you're developing and I'll let you give a better definition of which explanation of what you're doing in a moment, but the focus is on Alzheimer's and dementia related to Parkinson's and other conditions. I mean, this is a wide open field, huge, huge patient demand, devastating diseases and conditions, and desperate need of solutions. Pharma's falling short far too often. Everything else has just been, you know, managing of the person's decline. Nothing has really been, I think, a hopeful ad. We're seeing though some technologies, medical technologies that are coming through. But at the time, did you look at this and see that green field of opportunity, or did you see the littered husks that were on the roadside that had tried to solve the problem and say, I don't want to move into that space?
It's a wonderful way to sort of phrase that, because the road has been littered, right?
Yeah.
With the sort of failed challenges. For me, I'd love to tell you that my calculation was as clear as it is today. What it was it felt like to me, one, a patient population that was in such desperate demand. Right. Yep. I mean, I really do appreciate you bringing up it, because the patients are the North Star for us. And we do want to make sure we kind of keep them front and center, just because this is such an incredibly predatorial disease. Right.
Yep.
We're talking about, you know, 8 million people in the United States, I think is the latest estimate. There are as many as 15 million people that are that have mild cognitive impairment. So, we'll likely progress. Many of those, I think it's north of 10 or 12 million, are undiagnosed because there's been a reticence to become diagnosed, just because it's been difficult to diagnose and there's been a lack of therapy. So the value of being diagnosed, if I don't know what I can do to treat it, has always been a part of the calculation. It is, I always talk about it as being a plus one disease. It doesn't just impact the patient,
Absolutely.
But it has an enormous impact on the families and the caregivers. I mean, the average American family, I think, over the course of a loved one's disease will spend $400,000 out of pocket managing long-term care and memory care and things like that. It is outrageously impactful to the U.S. economy. It is, I think, currently $400 billion and soon to be $1 trillion of expense. So it really is the sort of, I hate to say it, but the kind of last frontier where there is just not a disease-modifying therapy for the vast majority of patients. Now, Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and I've shared this previously. My mom was diagnosed, she stuttered, showed her decline in the probably 30 years ago. She had to retire early. And she had it for 15 years or so after that. And I can't see point to any, so this is 30 years, and I can't really point to anything. Oh, I wish we had X. When she, like, there are certainly some benefits, but there's nothing that's transpired. And you're right in terms of the impact on the family. I mean, you basically, you have memories of two people, like the person before they got sick and the person after they got sick. And I always tell my wife, like, oh, you didn't know my mom before she got sick. She was like a different person. So it has a devastating and a long, never ending impact on a family. So it's a critical, critical field.
It is, you know, I oftentimes tell this story when I get the chance to talk publicly of Justice O'Connor, right? Sandra Day O'Connor, obviously the first female justice Supreme Court, let President Bush at the time know in January that the end of the Supreme Court term, she was going to be stepping down because her husband John had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. By the time December came around, John's disease had progressed so much that he had not only forgotten who Sandra was, but he had been moved into a memory care and had fallen in love with another woman. She still stepped down from the, because she wanted to be with John. Even to your point, if he was a different person, he still, you know, encapsulated the person that she had loved for so many years. He passed away. She became, you know, certainly very, very much an advocate for Alzheimer's disease. 10 years later, diagnosed herself and, you know, most likely died not knowing John, not knowing that she was ever one of the most impactful women in the history of the United States. And what I find most, I mean, as horrific as that story is, when I come off stage, the first thing I hear is that story is not novel, right? That story is not unique. That my mom or my dad or my brother. And so like, and honestly, like it was, I did not have it touch my family. So I don't think I was as, I don't think I understood it. And I've really spent the last several years trying to, you know, talk to as many families, as many patients, as many advocacy groups as possible, because I think that really understanding the plight of family like yours is incredible. You know, that's, you know, I say to people all the time, I get up every morning excited, and I get up every morning with energy. And a lot of it is because, right, this is incredibly meaningful work. If we can deliver on what we think the prospect of what Spectris can be. So, I appreciate you letting us take a couple minutes on the disease itself.
Oh no, it's a critically important and you know, I know as we're recording this, the Red Sox and Yankees are playing each other, and there's nothing like it. And I feel like you're the Red Sox is sort of a mental, like so many people are watching what you do, and like all their hopes are wrapped up in your success. So there's a lot of, you're right, you get up and you feel very passionate in the morning, but there's a lot of people watching you and they're rooting for your success, and you don't want to disappoint them. So not to make this about baseball, I make everything about baseball.
Yeah. Philly started against the Dodgers soon, so we're okay.
So let's talk about Cognito's approach. Yeah. As I mentioned, we'll have Ralph Kern, your chief medical and scientific officer at Device Talks West. It's an exciting space. He'll be on a panel with a couple of cool BCI companies. Neurology. Let's zoom out. Neurology overall. What have you come to? That hasn't been a primary focus of yours in your career. So in these 2 years that you've been or so you've been at Cognito, what have you come to appreciate about the neuro space?
You know, it's what has really shaped my thinking about the neuro space, I think, is why I am so enthusiastic about our studies and what I, you know, the likelihood, I think, of our studies reading out and showing a treatment effect, which is, one, I feel like many neurological disorders and certainly neurodegenerative disorders have been singularly sort of addressed using chemistry. And I think what we have seen, and certainly, I consider myself a dye-in-the-wool medical device person, is that medical devices have disrupted drug therapies in many ways, right? We have seen it in cardiovascular disease with a lot of the advancements that have been made instead of drug therapy. We see it in oncology. My wife's a radiation oncologist, right? What we see with not just radiation, but things like Novocure and others. But it feels like, and we've even seen it in neurology with things like deep brain stimulation and other neuromodulation. But I think because so much of it has been about the focus of the pathology of Alzheimer's disease, that I think sometimes there is a mistake that the best way to address pathology is with targeted molecular biologies to that pathology. Now, the challenge, so one, I think this idea that a medical device or a physics-based intervention can be enormously impactful is very exciting, right? Because the central nervous system provides us this really elegant on-ramp to be able to, you know, we the blood-brain barrier is a real challenge for drug therapies. We get to use the CNS to find targets in which we can modulate. So that's very exciting for me. Two is Alzheimer's is not a single pathology disease. It is a polypathologic disease. And so what you need to be able to do is you need to be able to drive multiple mechanisms of action. Well, what the teams at MIT and others have learned is that by stimulating the brain to a particular activity level, and the activity level that we target to is 40 hertz or gamma, which is when the brain is most active, what you see is this profound biologic expression. So you see synaptic proteins expressed, which helps drive synaptic plasticity. You see myelin proteins expressed that we can see in the imaging. So that helps generate and fortify the neurons as we produce a myelin. You see lymphatic system key on. You see other cognitive resilient proteins key on. So what the brain is able to do, the brain serves as a bit of a factory of mechanisms. So rather than trying to take a mechanism and target a pathology, if you can activate the brain safely and appropriately, it will drive a series of biology and that we have, you know, really validated through biomarkers that have a that create a bit of a neuroprotective environment. And that's why I think we're so excited, because I think one, physics is just shining a light on its ability to drive biology. Two, it is for neurology, it is a much more effective and elegant way to access work, and it allows us to do it in a non-invasive way. And then three, it allows us to drive sort of these multiple mechanisms. What they learned at MIT was that the most effective way to drive that brain activity was by stimulating the optic and the auditory nerve using sound and light. And so they were able to show, one, that it could safely and effectively drive that activation within the brain. And then two, they were able to begin to study the downstream biology of it. And so what it empowered was the creation of Cognito, which is a non-invasive headset, the Spectris AD, which is a headset that patients wear in our studies to date. They wear it for an hour a day, every day. We are currently in our fifth human study.
A consecutive hour, or can they break it up into like...
Consecutive hour. Yep. Okay. So, and I think what's really exciting is when patients or participants come into our study, we do two things. The first thing we do is we confirm, or we ensure that they can tolerate the therapy. And there are some patients that have sensitivity to light, or if they're more progressed in their disease, might struggle sitting for that hour. Mm-hmm. But, you know, north of 95% of patients are able to tolerate the therapy. We then, under an EEG, turn the therapy on and confirm that we get a gamma response. And so, you know, north of 92% of patients were able to get a gamma response. In the 8% were not, it's usually due to hearing loss. So they can't, you know, so we have not allowed hearing aids in the study to date. But that allows us to confirm that the patients are getting a gamma response. And so, you know, we're incredibly excited. We are fully enrolled in the HOPE study. It is a 12-month sham-controlled randomized clinical trial across 70 sites in the United States. I believe it is the largest non-pharmaceutical study in neurodegenerative disease or Alzheimer's disease. We will read out in August of 2026. We are measuring the preservation of cognition and function in mild and moderate Alzheimer's patients, which is, I think, incredibly hopeful given that there is not currently anything available to more progressed Alzheimer's patients. Some are eligible for the monoclonal antibodies, but the vast majority of patients with mild and moderate disease have no therapy available to them. And then we are a breakthrough device with the FDA. So we are working closely with our teams there to be prepared soon after that top line readout to submit, and then with a hopeful expectation of an approval in mid early 2027.
So again, this is a headset that has kind of like a VR headset that covers your eyes and also earphones that deliver sound. So very, very non-invasive. Are you slowing the progression? Are you reversing? What's the hope? What do you hope?
Yeah.
What's the hope of hope?
Hope's the right study. Word, right? Because we're currently studying. We're not quite there, right? So I want to be sensitive to the language of what we do versus what we're measuring. So in our Overture study, what we found was that we were able to preserve function, and we use a battery called the ADCS-ADL, which is the Activities of Daily Living, and we showed a preservation of 77% compared to the sham. We show the preservation of cognition using the mini mental state exam, which is the MMSE, which is a widely used cognitive battery in this patient group. And we showed 76% preservation there. And then we were also able to show a 69% preservation of total brain volume. Mm-hmm. And so we're also incredibly enthusiastic about the limited number of adverse events that we saw associated with the device and the adherence that we saw. So mm-hmm. we saw north of 85%, or I think it was on 85% adherence, meaning patients were using it at least 50 minutes a day, at least 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. And so that gave us real clarity on how we should design and structure the HOPE study, right? It was, we know the endpoints. We have confidence in what we should, you know, how we should be measuring those endpoints. What's the patient population we should be studying, inclusion, exclusion criteria. And so we really tried to mirror that as much as possible and hope just at a larger scale so we could power the study.
So again, you're in trials, so we don't want to, we'll see how things produce it. We're all, as we said, very, and not to keep using the word hope, but very hopeful. How do you envision, if you were successful, how do you envision this changing the treatment paradigm? You mentioned earlier on that people are reluctant to even reveal that they have this, even to pursue it, even to the doctors, because I think there's a, like, why should I? Like, I'd rather keep it to myself. There's nothing I can do. Something like this or a similar product could change that. If they go and they get help early on, perhaps it buys them a year, 2 years, who knows? Do you see this changing how the disease is treated and how people sort of perceive their options?
I do. And I'm candidly, I'll use the word as well. That's my hope, right? Which is one, I think, you know, our expectation is that this will be available to a very large number of patients, right? Given what we've seen in the studies and what we're expecting to see here. We don't see the sort of narrowing of the eligible population. So we're really looking forward to making sure that we can reassure that in the HOPE study. I think that then says, okay, there is a effective, convenient, it's in my home, cost-effective way of preserving cognition and function in the face of this disease. And I think, not to go back to your experience with your mom, but routine is everything mm-hmm. for patients as this disease progresses. And when you start to disrupt that routine with consumption of healthcare and imaging and all of it, it becomes very, very disruptive. Versus what we have seen in the studies is this idea: as I get up, I have breakfast, I sit with my Spectris for an hour. Patients have told us they feel like it's meditative. They feel like they're empowered taking on their disease. Again, we've seen this very strong adherence. We've seen patients wanting to stay on into what are called open label extensions, which are studies that, continue to show durability and bring those that were on sham onto active. So to me, it's very, I think it has the potential to provide mm-hmm. A therapy to not a small fraction of the patients that are suffering from this, and to do it in their homes, which we know is the overriding want of these patients and their families, which is, I want to stay in my home. Mm-hmm. I want to maintain function. I want to maintain cognition. I want to keep my memories. I want to keep it. I want to lean into therapies that allow me to do that.
Yeah. And if they have to go to a center and sit in a big chair, That's a, someone has to give them a ride if they're having trouble. And it's, I mean, this makes it so much easier. I'm guessing there's cases of patients not wanting to give up their headsets after a trial's over. Is that,
anecdotally, we just know that there is a clear bond built.
Yeah.
And I get it, right? I've been given this incredibly scary diagnosis.
Yeah.
You have confirmed for me that my brain is responding to this, you know, to this therapy or to the stimulation. There is an enormous amount of clinical and preclinical evidence supporting what the biology that is driving. I get why we're seeing high adherence and why we're seeing, you know, continued support. And candidly, it is one of the things I think that does make the Cognito story, in many ways, so unique, is that the science of gamma or 40 hertz stimulation has been so widely studied.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just feels like I am incredibly fortunate to be able to be here at this moment in time where I get to stand on the shoulders of those giants and sort of say, like, look at, you know, we're bringing this incredible, you know, really well validated both preclinically and now clinically to market. And now the next step in that is trying to figure out how we get it to, you know, once approved, to as many patients as possible.
Final question. Again, we're early on. I don't want to get too far ahead, but one of the things that's fascinating about neuro, and came up in our prep call for the conversation we'll have at Device Talks West, is once you effectively access the brain, you've got a wide open field of opportunities once again. You know, the BCI folks talk about robotics, things like that. I mean, going beyond neurotrip with yours, if you find it's improving brain function in people whose brains are less than healthy, do you envision that this being something that perhaps has other applications beyond dementia, beyond Parkinson's, beyond Alzheimer's, that is just performance enhancing, just lifestyle? I mean, is this a bigger opportunity as well?
It's a great question, what I'll say is, the first is to be studied, right? To be explored. Yeah. but let me say it this way, which is, you know, look, I am not immune to the idea that the sort of first principle headwind of Cognito in this is that it's so simple that it almost seems implausible, right? Like this idea of, like, right, sound and light is going to drive activity in my brain, which is going to express biology, which is important to preserve. But what that mandated, understandably, was then a significant investment needs to be made to validate it clinically, right? And so because that bar was set and now is being met, what it does is it gives us a tremendous amount of data to then inform what's next, right? So we know this idea of synaptic plasticity is not just important to those with a neurodegenerative condition, but it's important broadly. We know the idea of preserving brain volume is not just important to those with a neurodegenerative disease. It's important broadly. Glymphatic system and making sure, you know, that's why we talk so much about sleep, is that we want to make sure that we're filtering our brain. So I am incredibly excited that what was once a headwind that we met now turns into this massive tailwind, which is, okay, it's becoming clinically validated, or it will be clinically validated. It is well researched. We are going to understand the risks of it, and we're going to have these clear signals of where we can explore it further. And, you know, I'm being very intentional that we are standing up what are called brain health collaboratories, which are big, robust partnerships with a narrow group of health systems, so that we can not only explore what the, you know, clinical introduction and the additional health economic and outcome research that we'll need to do around the therapy, but also kicking off studies in Parkinson's and MS and stroke and other areas, so that we can move, you know, kind of take advantage of some of those capital efficiencies that come as a medical device and gain as much evidence as possible, so that we can get this to any person or patient in need that is thinking about, you know, neuroprotection and brain health. Because there is constant feed of data that tells me this has the ability to be impactful, or the capability of being impactful far beyond just the mild to moderate Alzheimer's group.
Awesome. Well, so your story is great. Cognito's story is great. You get extra points for using the word shibboleth. I think this is the first time it's found its way into one of my podcasts, and I love that word. So you get an extra badge for that. Christian, it was great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, Tom, thanks so much. And best of luck with Device Talks. It's great. It's great to get connected.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Please do join us at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th. Go to west.devicetalks.com. Use the code DTWeekly25 to save 25%. Great lineup of speakers, great lineup of conversations. It will be an impactful 2 days. So if you're listening to this while watching all the magic that's probably happening at AdvaMed, just know that we are there for you. We will be there for you October 15th and 16th. Don't miss out on another great conference. Make sure you join us on October 7th. Kayleen Brown will be leading a deep dive with Boston Scientific. She'll be talking with Dennis Chang. He's the Vice President of Cardiac Diagnostic Solutions at Boston Scientific. And the title of the deep dive is Medical Diagnostics in the Age of AI, and it's brought to you by Electrocraft, S3 Connected Health, Interpower, and MTD Micro Molding. So we'd like to thank those sponsors for making that conversation happen. And you'll be happy listening to the conversation between Kayleen and Dennis. Should be a fascinating discussion. I won't be on that deep dive. I'll be at AdvaMed. But Kayleen Brown is going to crush it. So don't miss out. Go to devicetalks.com to register. And it's free. You can watch it live and get your questions answered right there and then. You can also watch on demand. We won't be able to get questions answered as we typically do with these events. So I would recommend, if you have questions for Dennis and want to learn directly from him, that you watch live. So that's 4 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday, October 7th. Go to devicetalks.com to register for that. And finally, of course, make sure you subscribe to Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode of our great Device Talks podcasts. All right, folks, I think that's it. I think I've covered everything. If you're listening to this and you're heading out to AdvaMed, I will be there. Keep an eye out for me. I would love to say hello and just learn more about what you do, because you're doing something really cool and I want to talk to you about it. So, and of course, I look forward to seeing you all at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.